Hey, welcome to Night School, Friday night, Night School, night, night. And the topic for this episode is going to be pretty perfect for nighttime, a dark winter night. Gets dark around 4:30 now, so what better topic than the dark fantasies of men and women, specifically as they relate to true crime and an interest in true crime, criminality, serial killers, all those general subjects. And what made me think of this, funny enough, is I was listening to that comedian Theo Von's podcast, and I very rarely listen to him. He's kind of a goofy guy. I've never seen his comedy. I'm not a fan, but he's a very earnest guy, there's something very honest about him, and sometimes he'll have a serious guest on his podcast. And in this case, he had Chris Hansen from To Catch a Predator, and something that sparked my thought, something that made my thoughts go and inspired this episode was they were talking about how the demographic who is most interested in crime TV shows, murder mystery TV shows, true crime, speaking specifically for the true crime element, not necessarily fictional murder, fictional crime, but the people who watch those murder mystery shows, I can't even think of the names of them, 24 hour, isn't there something like that, 24 hours? I don't know the names because I don't listen to them. I'm not in that demographic, but there's this overwhelmingly female demographic who is interested in that stuff. I think about my mom. She watches a lot of those shows. They give a breakdown even of just one individual murder where some husband killed his wife. There are so many stories like that, and they have TV shows for virtually all of them. And I also know a lot of women who are younger. There's women in my mom's age range. She's in her 70s, but women who are, say, that mom age, you know. There's also a lot of younger women who watch that stuff. And as they were talking about on this Theo Von episode with Chris Hansen, a lot of the viewers of that stuff are women, overwhelmingly. And Theo was asking why that is. And I thought this was very funny because he was talking to Chris Hansen, who is a good-natured guy, but he's also very serious. He's a journalist. That tone that he had on To Catch a Predator, that way he carried himself, he carries himself that way, maybe a little more casually, but he carries himself that way in just casual interviews as well. But Theo asked him, he was like, you know, what's up with that demographic? You know, what's up with, like, so many women watching those shows? He's like, I kind of think that there's like a part of women that kind of want to imagine that they're the victim. They kind of like have a fantasy of being the victim of a murder and that kind of thing. And him asking Chris Hansen of all people that question was funny. And Chris Hansen, of course, shut it down. He's very, I don't want to say politically correct, because that term has come to mean something else. But he's very neutral, let's put it that way. So he wasn't going to indulge that idea that so many women watch these murder shows, they follow true crime cases, these documentaries, these true life TV shows, that they follow them because they secretly are fantasizing about being murder victims. it's not a thought Chris Hansen's going to entertain. But along with it making me laugh, it also made me think, because I've had that thought before myself. I've known a lot of women. I've had a lot of friends who are very into that stuff. And first of all, I don't know any men who watch those TV shows. I know a lot of guys who are interested in serial killers, true crime, crime of different kinds, who follow those sorts of nonfiction stories, whether it's in books, I can't think of anything else, documentaries, whatever it is, they have their own interests. But they definitely don't watch those TV shows. There are a lot of podcasts. There are a lot of true crime podcasts. And what I've heard with those, with a number of these true crime podcasts, especially the ones that follow serial killers, is they are overwhelmingly followed by women once again. I know there's some very popular podcasts that have a very wide age range of women following them, from housewives to college girls to everything in between. And that's very interesting to me that so many women do follow those. And I'm not going to say that, yeah, women follow them because they want to be killed. I don't think that's really where that fantasy comes from. But I think there is a part of women that does like to identify on some weird level with the victims in these cases, not because they want to be murdered, but I think they ultimately want to stop the killer. You look at horror movies, some of the more popular ones from Night of the Living Dead, that's an older one, the Halloween series. It's about a woman who isn't just the hero. She's not the detective. She's not just some random good Samaritan who stops the killer and solves the crime spree, stops the killings. She's actually the victim in those cases, and the victim ends up becoming the hero in those stories. The female victim or would-be victim, I mean, I think you can say they, if they're being pursued at all, they're already a victim of something. Maybe not murder, but they're already a victim. I think if you get chased by a guy with a knife, you're a survivor and a victim in your own right. But they become the hero at the end of the story. And I think that that's one draw to these true crime stories, to these TV shows, to these podcasts. I think that's one of the interests that women have, is the idea of being pushed just to the brink. Because I don't think there's any fantasy in a guy accosting them on the street and they pull out a taser and shock him, and then it turns out he was a killer and they stopped this killer just by chance. They nipped it in the bud. I think that there's this idea of taking it to the brink of almost being killed, and then you stop the guy. You save yourself, for one, but you also save the day on a bigger level by stopping this guy from going after future victims in solving the case, and also saving your own hide. So I think on some deeper subconscious level, that's a part of it. But there is a victim component. Not because women want to be, they don't want people to feel sorry for them. They don't want to be seen as weak necessarily. But I think there's something about, I think just the nature of women. And I think this, you look at romance novels, where romance novels are overwhelmingly about a powerful man coming into the picture. He's often either very wealthy, or he's an outlaw. He has something, there's some kind of primitive just power to the men in those stories. A lot of them are about pirates. I mean, seriously, look at the romance section, and those things are still coming out. And there's, you know, you go to a used bookstore and look at the romance section. Look at how many fucking books there are. You know, there is a market for that. Even if some of them just sat on the shelf of Payless and nobody ever read them, there are so many, and many of them have been popular. Many of them sell. And they are almost always about a power fantasy where the man is powerful. And I don't think that's social brainwashing. It's that chicken or the egg argument, and you hear it a lot these days, and I rally against it. But there's that chicken and the egg argument where it's like, did society create this in the brains of people, or did the brains of people create this in society? And you see it a lot with the whole, in my opinion, bullshit toxic masculinity argument, which is based on a reality. There is a very sick element to male aggression, and many of the things that are identified as toxic masculinity are toxic, to say the least. I wouldn't necessarily use the word toxic. I'd use the word criminal, and I'll get into that because I think that actually plays into what I'm going to talk about next. But there's some very bad things associated with being a man, being masculine, and I don't hesitate to talk about those things. I've talked about them at length on this show over the years, from the very beginning, with some of the songs I play on the Every Night's a School Night editions of this show. I've always made it a point to highlight that because it's fascinating, it's strange, it's even sickening, and it's just something that I think about. But that said, there is the other side of that, and women are drawn to the positive aspects of that masculine aggression, of that power. And while there is a certain type of woman who I think is attracted to the worst of the worst, they are attracted to the worst manifestation of masculinity, which is why you have serial killers in prison getting love letters, getting married, Richard Ramirez having women practically beating down his cell doors. You know, you have a lot of these cases, even unattractive guys, even extremely unattractive, uncharismatic serial killers have had great interest from women. And I mean that on just a base level, if they were just a guy walking down the street, uncharismatic, unattractive. Because you could say simply being a serial killer makes someone unattractive, which I think is a very fair point. But still, just on an objective level, these guys who otherwise wouldn't attract women at all, suddenly have women interested, and they kill women. They, you know, torture women. They rape women. They do everything that you shouldn't do to a woman. And here, because they do that, they somehow get an interest. And maybe they wouldn't if they were out on the street, if they weren't caught for their crimes. But maybe those women are drawn to those guys because they know he's incredibly dangerous, powerful in a certain respect, but they also know he's behind bars. So there's that element of safety. It's like you can get very close to the beast. You can get closer to the beast than you ever would if you were out on the street without being killed. But there's that set of bars between you. There's that plexiglass. So even if you put your hand up on the plexiglass when you're having a visit, and he puts his hand up on the plexiglass, and your fingers almost touch, there's still that thin layer of plastic. And I think that is part of the draw, because it's like you're getting, you know, so close to the beast, and you're getting into the monster's heart, but there's still that little layer that's keeping you safe. But I do think that there is... an overwhelming element of like wanting to be the victim slash hero, the victim hero. And we live in a world where we often confuse victims and heroes as it is. We often call survivors of crimes heroes, even though they didn't necessarily stop anything. And I'm not trying to take anything away from victims and survivors, but it has become sort of this weird narrative in modern America, at the very least, I think the modern West in general, I don't know what the rest of the world is like, where we elevate victims and we call them heroes simply for surviving. And I think surviving is incredible. I think being able to survive trauma, survive horrible circumstances is powerful. And I think there's a certain power in being a victim and being a survivor. But we've started to paint those people as heroes, and that's sort of strange. But I do think in these horror movies, for example, going back to Halloween, going back to Night of the Living Dead, Jamie Lee Curtis in the former, I can't remember who the actress was in the original Night of the Living Dead, or even the sequel or the remake, I just can't remember. But it was this woman who is just this close to being killed. You know, she is this close to just being a casualty, but she manages to overcome. And that's an example of a true victim turned hero. Not these cases where someone simply survives a crime and then gets, you know, treated like, oh, you overcame something, you're the hero. That's a true example of someone becoming from victim to hero. But I do think about that fantasy, and if that is the draw to some degree. I know a lot of it is just kind of the same reason it's fascinating to anybody. I know a lot of people watch those shows, listen to those podcasts, read those books, follow those stories, because it's just interesting. It's psychology. It's sociology. It's the dark underbelly of our entire species, and why wouldn't you be interested in that on an intellectual level or a fucking emotional level? It doesn't matter why you're interested in it. It's just, how could you not be on some level interested in where that stuff comes from, how it manifests, all of that, how it manifests. But then you turn around and you look at the male side of it. And in the same way that I do believe there is an element of women in that very large demographic who kind of does have a fantasy at the very least of being pursued by a killer. And just to add one more thing to that before I go on to the other side, I've actually observed in women I know, and I'm not calling anybody out on the carpet here. There's no carpet here. This is just a bare concrete floor. That's all this is. That's all you need to imagine is a bare concrete floor. But I've actually known women who have been in situations where there was an element of danger. And dare I say, I noticed a little bit of a thrill, you know, not that their lives were immediately at stake. I'm not saying that when a woman is being harassed by a man or stalked by a man or anything, that they are necessarily enjoying that. But I have seen when there is just a relatively safe situation with just a little hint of danger, I have seen a glint in people's eyes before, and it made me think. It didn't make me think any less of people, but it did make me think, is there a part of you that is getting a thrill out of this? And if so, why? Because there are some people who, you know, as I was kind of alluding to earlier, are so damaged that they will want to date or marry a serial killer who's behind bars. There is a woman who wants the ultimate bad boy, even if it puts her life at risk, even if, I mean, women date abusers. They date a lot of people, and there's a lot of manipulative shit that goes into that. I'm not saying people choose that for themselves. There's a lot of horrible stuff that's much bigger than any woman or women as a whole that reinforces those situations. But when it comes to just dangerous circumstances, I have seen a certain glint in more than one woman's eyes when a possible situation was presenting itself. And like I said, not when imminent danger is there, not when, you know, the monster is literally breathing down someone's back, but just when there's a little hint of, you know, terror. It's almost like wanting there to be a boogeyman in the closet or wanting there to be a monster under your bed. Because if you remember at sleepovers growing up, like my friends and I, when we were in late elementary school and we first started having sleepovers and we were a little bit more ballsy, we started to sneak out at night and we'd go to playgrounds, we'd go to schools, we'd go, you know, at the edge of the woods, we'd go somewhere and we would trick ourselves into believing that there was a guy lurking just beyond our periphery. Oh, you see him over there? You know, we'd get into this mindset, and of course we were boys, but we would get into this mindset where we would just psych ourselves out. We would freak ourselves out. And the next thing we knew, we would be seeing that guy. We would actually believe he was there. And none of us wanted to call each other's bluff. And it's sort of that collective psychosis that happens in all sorts of ways in our world. Groups of people are capable of seeing things and imagining things that aren't there. And that's happening right now. It's happening in politics. It's happening in endless social situations. But it happens even with little boys who are sneaking out at night at sleepovers and just looking off into the dark shadows of, you know, on the edge of a building. Oh, you see him? Oh, he's wearing this. You know, I can't think of how many times we made up little just weird characters who were lurking just beyond our field of vision. You could just see his shadow, and we'd run back to the house and climb back in the window we opened. And it was fun. That's what I'm getting at, is we did that not because we just had this desire to freak ourselves out, not because we wanted some real guy to be there who was going to kill us or something like that, but we did it because the thrill. Because there was a thrill to it. And I think that's what draws people to those sorts of shows. It's why people watch fucking horror movies. I mean, this is obvious stuff. But it's different, you know, when you're dealing with nonfiction. Because, I mean, horror movies always have that element of disbelief. Oh, that doesn't look real. That don't fool me. You know, people love to watch horror movies for that reason. Even if it's like a really well-made horror movie, people still kind of take that mentality to it where it's like, oh, I'm just here to make fun of it. I'm just here to make fun of this stuff. And they watch very low-budget horror movies because it's even easier to point those things out. God forbid a horror movie turns real while we are watching it. But to go to the other side of that, like I was saying, how there's an element in women's interest in true crime that sort of has a very weird and slight victim fantasy. I think the other side of that coin is that men who are interested in that stuff sort of have a killer fantasy. They might not actually want to be a killer. They might not have, in all probability, they don't have violent fantasies. They don't have any sort of bloodlust or a desire to torture people or even do everything leading up to that. They don't have a desire to stalk the night and hunt people. They don't have any of that. But I think there is this element in men that does sort of identify with the killer, who at the very least, if you take away all the crimes, is a rogue, person of mystery. It's somebody who has a deep secret that they don't want to tell. And it's not that much different when you look at it that way from the old outlaw movies, from old Clint Eastwood movies where he shows up to a town, old westerns, where he's a gunslinger in black who shows up to a town and he has some secret that nobody knows and he won't let up. You know he's holding on to something. You know he has something that he won't tell people from his past. Or even his present. He's something that he doesn't want to share with the town, this gunslinger. He has something behind him that he's not sharing, some secret, some maybe dark secret. But there's ultimately something fascinating about him. You like this character. He's the star of the movie. It's not like Clint Eastwood was playing a bad guy. Although that's another aspect of it, and I think that plays into what I mean when I say that men who follow true crime, who obsess over serial killers and just follow that whole subject, I think there's an element in it that goes back to the idea that it's fun to play the bad guy, or it's fun to imagine what the bad guy, what it would like to be the bad guy. If you've ever even had a tiny interest in acting, if you're a guy or a woman or whoever you are, this kind of goes for anybody, because men and women can never have anything in common, of course, ever. And I'm, you know, these two different forms of fantasy I'm talking about, they don't cross over at all, never, you know. Everything's black and white. No, but really, if you've ever had even a tiny interest in acting, you've probably thought it would be really fun to play a bad guy. And more fun than playing a bad guy would be playing the bad guy. Because it's not like you want to play a henchman. It's not like you're sitting there being like, oh, you know, if we're doing Peter Pan, I'd like to be Smee. I'd like to be his little, the short little fat henchman. I've always just wanted to play a henchman. I want to be a character actor who plays Smee. No, it's not how you go about it. You want to play Captain Hook. Or if you're a girl, you want to play the witch. You want to play the big evil. You don't want to play the little minion. You don't want to do that. You want to play the big, bad, evil, and that's exactly what a serial killer is. He may not have henchmen, but he's the big, bad, evil, and I think there's a certain draw to that. When you take away the horrible reality of the crimes, the true reality of the crimes, of what a crime scene looks like, and what it means for a serial killer to actually hunt somebody and capture them and torture them and do God knows what. When you take away the immediate reality of it, you're left with the bad guy. And I do think there's something in men that is drawn to that. And there's a reason why the bad guy is often made to look cool. Not that serial killers often look cool, but they do become iconic. Whether people want that or not, they ultimately become iconic. You can buy t-shirts, you can buy fucking mugs with serial killers' faces on them. You can buy a framed picture of Jeffrey Dahmer's mugshot on eBay right now. I bet you can get that. I know you can get little patches. You can get buttons. You can get like all this fucking shit, all this merch. You can get all this merch with these horrible bad guys' faces on them. You can get Ted Bundy underwear, I'll bet, you know? They make, maybe not, I don't know. By now, they probably make that. But you can buy any kind of merch with these guys' faces on them. And, you know, the bad guy is almost inevitably iconic. You know, you think about even in comic books, the bad guy has a certain shape to him, a very distinctive shape, and there's always something iconic about the bad guy, and I think there is a draw for men with that. And like I said, I don't think that is coupled, in the same way that I don't think that women actually want the reality of being strangled or attacked or stabbed to death. I don't think that's a part of the fantasy that I was talking about for women. I think in that same regard, men aren't drawn to the idea of hurting somebody. But I think that the bigger picture is they're drawn to the idea of these mysterious characters who do things their own way, who have a secret. It just turns out that doing things their own way is being the worst possible manifestation of reality that anybody could ever possibly imagine. And that's why, you have to be a healthy person. I feel like you have to be a healthy person to be interested in these things, whether you're male or female or something else. I don't know what, but, you know, no matter what you are, who you are, or what you identify with, I think you have to be a healthy person if you're going to be interested in these things. And I think you have to be interested for a reason. I mean, I always considered myself not a fan of true crime, but a student of true crime. And as I've said before in this show, I think I kind of reached the logical conclusion of that. But even then, even with that level of self-awareness, I think it's easy to get caught up in it. And I think it's easy to let that interest become a part of your own identity. And I know for me, it's like just like the bad guy has a certain draw to it, you know, whether I'm talking about this or any kind of bad guy, whether I'm talking about Venom from Spider-Man. I think he's a bad guy, right? Or is he one of those anti-heroes where he's kind of, you don't really know. But either way, you know, whether I'm a bad guy from a comic book, a clear black and white bad guy, or I'm just some serial killer who the horror of his crimes have been kind of distorted by this iconic presence that they've taken in pop culture. No matter what I'm talking about, you have to be a healthy person, I think, in order to know why you're interested in that. And to not let it get out of hand, because I think there is a certain type of person who does get interested in those things, and they are very mentally unhealthy, maybe physically unhealthy as well, and it does feed into some true pathological fantasy, some desire to hurt people, and they start to see these people as heroes. They start to see serial killers as heroes. They start to see criminals as heroes. You see it with school shootings even, I think, which is a completely different subject. School shootings, in my opinion, do not cross over with serial murder. I think those two things occupy a much different part of the brain, even though they both ultimately end in murder. But you see it with school shootings where these school shooters will... It turns out they idolized the Columbine shooters. It turns out they idolized this person who nobody should ever idolize. And so these wires do get crossed if somebody doesn't have a healthy brain. And I think it's that same sort of idea that goes behind women who want to marry Richard Ramirez or women who, you know, send love letters to these horrible serial killers. I think it's that same thing where something gets, you know, somebody who has had a bad background, who has experienced a lot of trauma, whose wires got mangled and crisscrossed in some horrible way for some horrible reason. Maybe they were just born that way. Maybe their experiences shaped them. But it ends with them taking what's kind of a natural human interest in the darkness, or a natural human interest in... a natural human desire to identify with something dark, and then turning that into... marrying a serial killer or becoming a serial killer. So I think that you should be very careful when you're interested in these subjects, and you should know why you're interested in them. At no point should you just take it for granted that you're, it's just a Saturday morning cartoon. Oh, I'm reading this. It's not entertainment. And that's something that concerns me actually about all of this stuff around, because there are so many fucking TV shows about it. There are so many TV shows about true crime these days, more than ever. And there's always been a lot of shows in my lifetime. But what concerns me is the idea of treating it as entertainment. It can be fun to kind of see it that way, and it can be kind of fun to like talk with other people who are interested in it and kind of treat it lightly and make jokes. I have no problem with dark humor. I have no problem with any of that. I have no problem with exploring these things artistically or creatively. Recording an album about a serial killer, or writing a song about a serial killer, drawing a picture inspired by one, or you know, just a portrait of one. I have no problem with that whatsoever, but I do worry that sometimes people treat it like it's just entertainment and not really a field of study. And I'm not saying you have to take an actual class on it, because I think if you took an actual class on true crime or serial killers, it would probably be really fucking boring. But I think if you're pursuing this stuff on your own, you should really treat it like a field of study and always keep yourself in check. But the other side of this fantasy, especially on the male side for me, is I've always had a strong detective fantasy. And I think my true fantasy in true crime comes from this place of wanting to be the detective who solves it all, but the detective who goes kind of rogue and is kind of a dark character himself, and you don't really know about him, but he ultimately turns out to be the good guy. I've always been drawn to those characters, what I've called the Black Knight characters. I've talked about that in old episodes. The Black Knight archetype. He looks bad. In the same way that I was talking about bad guys in comic books almost have a certain shape. They have more spikes. There's going to be more of a spiky outline to their presence, whether that's literal or just figurative. They have kind of a spiky outline, and they're silhouetted. That Black Knight archetype, that character, you don't really know if he's good or bad, and he's kind of neutral in a lot of ways. He doesn't really give in to the moral posturing, but in the end, he turns out to do good. He does what he can to try to save the day. He just has a more roundabout way of doing it. And doesn't posture while he does it. And you look at Racer X from Speed Racer, he would show up and he kind of looks like a bad guy. And I barely watched that show, so I don't even know if I'm completely right in using him as an example. But still, it's that sort of Racer X, the Black Knight. It's, you know, not Batman, not to be confused with Batman, because as I've said before, Batman is a superhero masquerading as an anti-hero. He's not an anti-hero, not in the way that characters like Spawn and the whole 90s era of let's make anti-heroes the main characters in everything. Let's make every movie and every comic book and every fucking story about an anti-hero. Because that was the big trend of started in the kind of the underground of the 80s. You had characters like the Crow, the early Crow comic books, and then in the very early 90s, you know, those guys split off from Marvel and started Image Comics, and all the characters of those comics were pretty much anti-heroes. And there's a draw to that. Like I said, I am drawn to that. I was never the kid who was like, I want to be Captain America. I want to be Spider-Man. I like Spider-Man. No, I was always drawn to the character who looks dark, you know, might not be friendly, might be in this kind of neutral gray area, but ultimately does good, ultimately does things for good, whether it's even intentional or not. So in that same way, I think that, you know, where my interest in kind of true crime came from, beyond just the dry sort of like studying it aspect, beyond just like considering myself a student of crime, trying to learn something about abnormal psychology and dark human behavior, beyond just that more clinical side of it, the sort of fantasy aspect, which I think is important if you're just a student in something. You know, if you consider yourself just a student of something, I think it's important, too, to have kind of a fantasy attached to it as well, because I think that will keep you interested. I think that will kind of fuel you, because we've all taken classes in school, in real school, not this fake night school student of true crime bullshit that I'm talking about very seriously right now. But still, like in real school, we've taken classes and we want to get into it, but we just can't really find that inner fire. And that inner fire is often fantasy. That inner fire often comes from a place of fantasy where we have some sort of bigger picture idea that we might never share with anybody, but we've associated it with some subject and it kind of keeps us interested. It turns us into like an autistic kid who's fascinated by trains, and you can get him a train for his birthday, or you can get him a book on trains every year for his birthday and he will never get tired of it. You know, you have to have an element of fantasy, and he secretly fantasizes that he's a conductor. And he's keeping all the trains on schedule. And that's why he doesn't mind getting a train book every year for Christmas and his birthday. I think it's the same thing for other subjects, too, where you kind of have to have an element of fantasy, some weird personal twist. And I think that is why people are interested in true crime, why they've stayed interested in it. And why they will continue to be. For me, I'm not anymore. I've realized that it takes its toll on you. It really does. Even if you have a healthy mindset, I think it takes its toll. And it does start to sort of blur a line between entertainment and study. And I think for that reason, I started to realize that it did make me a more negative person, not just because I saw those things I was reading about out in the world. It was very easy to look at somebody who's just kind of a creep and think the absolute worst of them. You know, it's very easy to see, you almost start to see the world through that lens. And God forbid you start to see the world through the lens of a killer, you know, not because you yourself are going to be a killer, but just starting to see the world through that lens. Well, how would a killer act in this situation? You know, the place where I was always most comfortable was the idea of being kind of the shadowy detective, the guy who, you know, he might be a morally ambiguous character in the story, but at the end of the day, he's going to solve the crime. But I realized, you know, even that wasn't healthy for me. And it's like anything, though, where I heard a depressed person say once that they were afraid of not being depressed because it had become such a core part of their identity. You know, being a miserable person had become such a core part of their identity. And it's not just the feelings of misery and depression and helplessness that they were attached to, but other aspects of themselves that they considered kind of an integral part of their character were attached to that depression. You think about if you're a creative person, if you're a musician, an artist, even a comedian, anything. You could be anything. And all those things kind of shoot off from, you know, your depression or whatever it is. It could be some people sing songs of joy, and if that joy were to go away, they might not be able to sing songs of joy anymore. Some depressed singer-songwriter might feel like they're going to lose their ability to write songs or perform songs in a genuine way, if nothing else. And but there are other parts of our character too, not necessarily creative, but we become attached to these other things. If I lose this part of my personality, even though it hurts me to feel this way, I feel like I'm going to lose these other things. It's a cliche of mental illness, schizophrenia. Oh, if I start taking the pills, it'll make the hallucinations go away. It'll make the delusions go away. I'm going to stop trying to kill myself. I'm going to stop trying to jump off of every building that I walk by. But I'm also going to lose my ability to think these incredible thoughts and make these connections between things to create this otherworldly art. It's the whole idea of not taking the pill, of not wanting to cure yourself because you're afraid that if you cure yourself, that nothing is going to be there. But there's something glorious about that. There's something glorious in clearing the air and seeing what's left, because you'll find that things are left. I don't know how I spiraled into this, but that's just how it happens. And for me, that was sort of the case with, you know, following true crime and being interested in that subject matter. And I'm still interested in it. I still talk about it. I still pay some level of attention. It's just not nearly as obsessive. It's not nearly as important. If I see something about it on TV, I will change the channel. If I see an article about something dark, I don't feel compelled to read it, and I feel better in doing that. But I was worried for a while when I first started to have these feelings that maybe I shouldn't pay attention to this stuff anymore. Maybe this stuff is coloring my worldview. It's making the world a little more gray for me. It's making my thoughts a little darker than they need to be. I was afraid to stop paying attention because I was like, this is one of my interests. This is something that I've been fascinated by since I was a little boy hiding on the stairs after I was supposed to go to bed, but my mom was watching a John Wayne Gacy documentary, and I just hid there on the stairs, just gripped. I was like, what is this? Is this real? Do people do this? You know, and that's a true story. I remember sitting there on the stairs, and I was just like, this is unbelievable. I am so scared out of my mind. But I felt a thrill. I felt a little thrill in hearing about this guy who killed boys in horrific ways, in ways that I were just paralyzing to me at the time. But still, I was fascinated, but I also felt this little thrill, like, this is something that I don't know. It's hard to really put that to words. I think anybody, though, who's been interested in this subject matter for a long time will tell you the same thing. I think they all get some little thrill out of it, and it's not a positive thrill, but it's a thrill. It's sort of the same thrill you get when you feel that something is threatening you, not when you're genuinely terrified that there's a knife to your throat, that there's a gun to your head. It's not that feeling, not that I've ever had either of those things happen, but it's still, it's not that there's an imminent danger that could just snuff you out right now, but it is a feeling that there's something lurking over in the shadows, that you've snuck out at night with your friends and you're 12 years old and you're freaking each other out by imagining that there's a guy in the shadows. It's that same exact feeling. And it's that's ultimately why I am, on any level, still interested in this stuff. I'm more interested in why people are interested in this stuff than I even am the actual subject matter itself. And so if I talk about true crime, if I talk about dark psychology and all this stuff, I think it'll be from that place. I think it'll continue to be just, why do we have such an interest in this? Beyond the aspect of, because, you know, there's obviously a part of it where people are interested in this stuff because it's self-protection, it's survival. I want to know what monsters are out there so that I can save myself from them. Because Chris Hansen on that podcast actually said something along those lines. It's like that he thinks that women, for example, watch true crime shows because they think, well, I want to know, you know, how to protect myself from guys like this. And I think that that's a part of it. I do think that's a part of it. But I don't think that's really why people are drawn back to those sorts of programs over and over again. Whenever I describe a TV show as a program, I feel really... I feel like a grandpa, a cool grandpa. These programs. But this program should probably come to an end. One last thought I had, it's not directly related to this subject matter, but it's related to the Iran's Golden State Killer case, which I talked about in episode 21 of Every Night's a School Night. That was when I first kind of expounded about it. The case was still unsolved then, and as I'm sure many of you know, the case was solved earlier this year. Huge news. It was a cold case for decades, and this serial killer who had killed 13 people, committed dozens upon dozens of rapes, a truly just vicious shadow, was revealed, and we found out who he was, and I don't need to say his name. I don't need to indulge this subject any more than I already have. But, you know, I followed that case very closely when it was still a cold case, and I got drawn deeply into it, and it was sort of the culmination of a lifetime interest in this, from thinking back to secretly watching the Gacy documentary after I was supposed to go to bed, from that moment up until following this unsolved Golden State Killer Iran's case, that was sort of the culmination of those years of being interested in this, from when my family first got the internet to going to crime library and reading these articles that were up there about these different cases and all of that, of going to the true crime section of every bookstore I've ever walked into in my life. So this Golden State Killer thing was just the culmination of all of that. And, you know, there was so much speculation, and people, I think, enjoyed the mystery. Even though a lot of the people who were following that case, of which there were hundreds, if not thousands of people who were following that unsolved case closely, more and more with time, as more and more TV shows started to spotlight on it, as the case kind of got reopened, more and more people were following it very closely and speculating, coming up with their own theories. And I think people got off on the mystery of it. I think people liked the idea of playing detective, of being the rogue, the independent person who's going to solve the case by themselves. You know, those cops weren't able to solve it back in the day, and they're just fighting amongst themselves. You know, they're having these jurisdictional rivalries, and they're never going to solve it. They're looking in the wrong places, and I'm going to be the guy who solves it. I'm going to be the independent rogue investigator who solves this case. I think a lot of people following that case, and who follow many cold cases, kind of like the role play, almost like they're who is it? What's the little girl detective? I can't even think of the name offhand. I was going to say the Hardy Boys, but there was the kind of the girl version of that where it's the little girl detective. I can't remember. But people like the idea of being that sort of character who, you know, against all odds, solves the case just through their own ingenuity. And I saw a lot of people sort of role-playing, pretending they were the little, you know, the little rogue detective. And I think, though, that, you know, even though there was a genuine, you know, humanitarian motivation to solving these crimes, bringing justice for the, you know, many victims of this, as I said, this monstrous shadow, because that's kind of what the guy seemed like. So little was known about him, and it was such a strange case. But I think, you know, there was, you know, ultimately a good-natured motivation behind a lot of that speculation and research and, you know, just, you know, rumor churning, you know, all of that. I think a lot of it was coming from a good place. But now that the case has been solved and, you know, a lot of details are being kept under wraps, and I allow myself once in a while to check up on the case. I don't indulge it very often because that's just not good for me. I do find myself checking in once every couple months since the guy got caught, just kind of saying, oh, what else has come out? You know, I followed the case so closely that I just want to know what facts have emerged. But I see a lot of the speculation now, and I think there's this part of people that is a little upset that he's caught, because and they want the cops to like answer all of their questions as if the cops owe the public answers to these questions right now. You know, a lot of this stuff will come out in time, be it in court or as investigators write books. You know, all this stuff ends up emerging with time. And I think part of that is people are used to just immediate information. They're used to the the 24-hour news networks just spitting out every piece of information that comes in about every horrible thing that happens on any given day. And they're used to getting all this information right away. They're on their phones. They're on their computers. They have access to information all day long. And they're used to getting it right now, 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 now. And so when something like this happens and there's due process, you know, they're not going to release all of the information about this guy. They're not going to release all of the information related to his crimes. You know, as this case is being developed, as it's, you know, as the prosecution is being developed, they're not going to reveal this stuff. It's not, once again, it's not entertainment. They didn't catch this guy so that you could be entertained. They didn't catch this guy so that all these internet sleuths, all these people who were role-playing as a detective on the internet for the past 10 years, you know, they didn't catch him so that those people could suddenly be entertained by a bunch of new information. But I think people have that kind of twisted up. And I think a reason for that is because there is so much entertainment masquerading as true crime, or rather, there's so much true crime masquerading as entertainment. I think that it has sort of distorted people's visions of it. And I think there is a part of people who, let's say, are still following this case now that the guy's been caught, who do kind of wish that it was still unsolved, because I think they found more entertainment and, dare I say, even pleasure in the speculation, in letting that shadow take whatever shape they wanted it to take. I think that people kind of enjoyed that. And, you know, I've talked before on this show about how I don't like to have mysteries ruined. And I think when things get over-explained, it often ruins the mystery. I used Star Wars as an example on an older episode where, you know, Star Wars, the original Star Wars trilogy was so successful, in my opinion, and as a kid who was fascinated by that, by Star Wars, along with John Wayne Gacy. But as a kid who just loved Star Wars, a big draw was the mystery. You knew the name of every character in the background, and you knew the name of every planet and the alien species that populated that planet and the entire history of that species. You knew all these details, but some things were left unexplained, like the Force. No matter how many characters were explained, no matter how many expanded universe novels were written that didn't need to be written about some background character in one of the movies, you know, no matter how much of that stuff you know, was created, you still didn't really know what the Force was. You know, it was this spiritual sort of energy, this spiritual sort of entity, whatever it was, you wouldn't even know how to describe it. And that was sort of the appeal of it. The appeal of something like The Force was that it wasn't explained. And then they created the prequels where they explain, they broke the Force down into this scientific, you know, midichlorians in the bloodstream, and it killed the mystery. And, you know, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but there are a lot of cases where killing the mystery just takes the life out of something. But once again, you know, true crime is not Star Wars. It is not entertainment. The story of a serial killer is not entertainment for, you know, public consumption. I would love to know more facts as they come out. I would love to still speculate about the mystery of it all. There is, it's, you know, it's once again seeing the guy in the shadows when you're at the sleepover and imagining a guy in the shadows so that you can freak your friends out and you guys get a thrill out of it and there's no imminent danger. I feel like people in today's world have a tendency to treat all of these real life cases that way. And I hope that we can kind of dial that back now that we are in this world where we have constant information, where we have all of these documentaries, TV shows, and we have these internet forums and these, you know, websites that are just dedicated to discussing this stuff and dissecting this stuff. And we have these podcasts that analyze these things to death, and everybody gives their take on them, and everybody forms sort of an identity based around this interest in the in these things. I hope that we don't mistake it for entertainment. I don't think you necessarily need to get rid of that fantasy element, though, in doing that. I don't think you necessarily need to, you know, kill that, whatever that fantasy is that brings you back around toward reading about this, you know, toward watching these. I don't think you necessarily need to remove that, because I don't think that fantasy is simply entertainment. I think that weird fantasy, that weird dark fantasy that men have, that women have, that people have, that draws them to true crime subject matter, I don't think that fantasy is entertainment to people. I think it goes into some much deeper ancient place than we're capable of comprehending. I think it goes back to the earliest days of man. And I think in some weird way, when we watch a documentary, when we read a book, when we hear some weird fact about a serial killer, when we hear about some bold move a victim did to save their life, I think that it brings us back to something very ancient. I think it takes us as, you know, as far back as we can go, as far back as our memory goes, and not just our memory as individuals, but our memory as an entire species. And in that way, I don't think those fantasies are perverse. I don't think those fantasies are just some sort of, you know, gross entertainment, but I think they actually tap into, you know, some greater understanding of what we are and why we are what we are today, as well as, how what we are today connects to what we were then. And I don't think it's that much different. No matter what our houses look like compared to the huts and caves we lived in then, I believe that things are not as different as we often trick ourselves into believing.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave, this golden land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, I see a land where children can run free. So take